You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. If you've got questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, buying and selling trucks and trailers, you name it, you've come to the right place because that's what we do here. We take your calls and we answer your questions about all of those things and more. We answer your questions about everything trucking. We can talk about health and fitness, living on the road, whatever it is you want to talk about. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. We're going to get to those calls in just a little bit. It's time for me to nag. I do this every once in a while, and I should probably do it more often. Are you taking advantage of your drive time? Are you listening to audiobooks and learning while you're driving? I've been doing this for so long, and the thing is, the more I do it, the more good books I find. I was just telling somebody the other day that in the last couple of years, I've gotten into a habit of reading multiple books at the same time, and I don't think that it's a good thing. And I'm having a hard time breaking the habit. Although I have to say, I'd much, much rather be reading multiple books than not be reading any at all. But I find it a little more difficult to focus on the lessons of a book when I've got three or four going on. The problem is, as I'm trying to break this habit, people keep giving me book recommendations, and there are so many good books coming out that I keep starting another one. And right now I have four books going, and I need to just commit to not starting another book until I finish these four. Or maybe I should just pick one, finish it, and then move to the next one. But either way, I don't care if you're reading one book or listening to one book or 10. It's so much better than what the average American does, which is the average American doesn't even read a single book after they graduate high school or college. There is so much good material. I've talked many times about the split we're seeing in society and in the industry and with people, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, the fit getting fitter, the unfit getting unfitterer. I know that's not a word, but you get the point. We're seeing this split, and there are so many things that are the cause of that, but one of them is there are people who continue to learn every day, and then there are people who don't learn virtually anything new. They just keep doing the same thing day after day after day. Those are the things that will make you fat, sick, dumb, and broke. There's actually a couple good books out about that topic right now. Fat, sick, and broke, I think, or fat, sick, and dumb. I'm going to put them all together. Our lifestyle today, the way that we live, and it's the pace of this is accelerating. The change is happening more and more often. The way we're living today is making us fat, sick, broke, and dumb. But the good news is it's easy to change. You've just got to start changing some habits. This is what I kind of set out on back in October of last year. I decided to change one habit. I was on roughly a schedule of changing one small habit a week. You could hardly notice the changes that I was making, but they build up over time. And then after a while, I made a couple big changes in diet and lifestyle. And the results have been amazing, and they just keep going. But a big part of that is reading and learning. There is a ton of new information and new research out. And I will tell you, you are not hearing this stuff anywhere in the mainstream media. you might get little tiny blips of it here and there. I've been watching. I've been paying attention to newspapers, radio, TV. We are surrounded by news, but it is the same regurgitated garbage over and over and over. And yet we're missing all of the really important new data that's coming out. You've got to go looking for it. It's out there in books. I've been recommending books all the time. I'm in the middle of another one now that I will probably be recommending shortly. I want to finish it though. And it really talks a lot about what civilization has done to us as far as our health, our happiness. You know, what this really all comes down to is happiness. And we think we can chase happiness through stuff and money and accomplishments, and we really can't. So I'll be talking about that more in the future, but get reading, get listening. You have so much time and there's so much good information. If you need a book recommendation, call me. I've got hundreds of them. Let's get to some phone calls. Let's start off in Pennsylvania. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing? I sent you a report for a MaxForce motor. This is a company truck, just to see what a report looks like. It's the first report I've ever seen. So I was wondering if you could tell me if this is actually an ECM report, or I think there's more than one type of report you can print.
There is, and depending on the ECM, you know, whether it's a Detroit, a Cat, a Cummins, this is a MaxForce, even the different years will produce different results. Like the early ECMs didn't capture nearly as much data as the more current ECMs. But a lot of the data is somewhat meaningless. For example, I think Pittsburgh Power figured out there are 6,000 variables in an ISX ECM. I mean, we can't even fathom that, but we don't need to. We can look at the important stuff. So this is the first report I have seen from a MaxForce, but it looks pretty clean. It looks fairly simple to understand. We can see the distance the vehicle has traveled, the total gallons of fuel used. Now, remember, this fuel usage is an estimate. It's a guess. There is nothing on that truck that can actually measure the amount of fuel consumed. There are devices that can do that called flow meters, and I've looked at them. The problem is they're about $1,000 a piece for flow meters that would work on a truck, and then it would get much more complicated than that because we'd have to measure the flow going into the engine, measure the flow going back out of the engine and the return fuel because we don't burn all the fuel we send to the engine, and then we'd have to have a computer to reconcile the two. So there really is no easy way to do this electronically on a truck. The good news is it's so easy to do yourself. You know, had this been one of those trucks where we have owner operators who bought a truck brand new and they have literally tracked every single tank of fuel they put in the truck. And we have some now that are over 1,000 fuel ups on their truck. We could have compared that to this and said, oh, look, you know, the computer thinks we burn 9,700 gallons of fuel and we really burned 11,000, you know, 280. But this
can
is still
good. You real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
If you go to check raise on the fuel, was it the fuel gauges?
Yeah.
It's almost pretty close.
Well, it could be. And that's the other thing. But that's almost worse sometimes because people either see that or they hear that and then they start to assume that, oh, look, the ECM is pretty close. I've seen some ECMs that are 2.5 miles per gallon off. I mean, that's not even in the same universe when we're talking about fuel mileage. Then I've seen others that come pretty darn close, but it's pure random. It's just chance. There's so many variables that go into it. So this is good information, but the best information is to use this and what you're doing, which is tracking in a system like fuel gauges. So we so can now, see. Oh, go ahead.
If I was looking at this report and it was a pre-emission motor, the only thing that concerns me, as far as I can tell in this report, is the low oil pressure on the third page. It shows like 2 hours in low oil pressure. Is that a normal number for let's say you ran the truck for 2 years?
You know, I don't know because I've never seen that number before. That is, and I've read a lot of ECM reports and I've never seen that tracked that way. And what it's showing is, it's showing a systems monitor for a specific trip. Doesn't give us the date. The system probably doesn't know the date. That's unfortunate because during this one trip, the oil pressure was low 17 minutes, but it was critically low for 34 minutes. But it doesn't tell us when that might have happened. The music's playing. I'm going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about this report. Interesting stuff. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to Pennsylvania. So, Dave, getting back to this report, then we see below that, we see that the same type of information, but instead of that one trip, we see it as a total. What I would imagine, so we had 35 minutes of critically low oil pressure in this one trip. Again, it'd be interesting to know what might have happened then. It's possible that maybe this max force is doing something similar to the ISX that we just identified, that the oil filters get clogged, the oil pressure drops. So it might have been towards the end of a service. And so then we see for the lifetime of this vehicle or for this period, 70,000 miles or so, that's happened a total of 2 hours. But if they only broke out one trip as being critical and we have 2 hours, it could have been that the rest of it is a minute or two here or there. And that could be, you know, nothing more than a situation where the RPMs drop, the truck's at a certain level, the sensor doesn't get enough pressure for a minute or two. I don't know. We would have to go back to the engineers that designed this system and find out how and why they're monitoring this stuff. The good news is if we were doing oil samples, we'd be able to see if there was any damage done from this. My guess is there wasn't. I don't know about this critically low oil pressure. Again, I don't know how they're measuring or what they're measuring. But
the good news is next week I'll have an oil sample for you, just because I'm interested in finding out all these things that you talk about for myself, what they look like.
Good, good. Well, we'll go over that and we'll compare it with this report. I don't think that's of any concern, although, like I say, I would have to do more investigation to figure out what they're monitoring and how they're monitoring it. The rest of the report, I've been trying to scan it here as I'm talking. It's got a nice breakdown. It gives us, you know, total fuel used, driving fuel used, idle fuel used. That's really good information. We can see overall during driving, the truck's done 7.2 miles to the gallon. That's a good number. I mean, no question for a fleet truck. If we look at, that was a trip. If we look at total 253,000 miles, 7.29 driving fuel economy, good stuff. I don't see anything else
So if this was a pre-emissions truck, these numbers look good?
Yeah, it is. Here's an interesting part of this report I've never seen either. The one thing I'd look for, if somebody comes to me and they say, I have to buy a truck with a DPF, I'm going to run California, I have to do it. As much as I hate it, you know, we've got to look. And one of the things we look at is regen. Now, this one is showing me an active regen. So we have, but they're not showing me the passive. Active regen, they're showing.
That's why I was wondering if there was more than one type of report. I'd be afraid to go to a dealership and they print me up a report that has some information that would be beneficial to look at, but they don't want you to see it.
Well, and that, who knows? There are different types of reports you can pull out of these things. This one is showing an active regen count of 585 in 253,000 miles. That seems like a lot. I mean, it's almost 300 hours of regen time, and it's showing fuel used as pounds, 2,400 pounds of fuel. We could divide that by seven, roughly seven or so pounds per gallon, and about 3.5. So we're like 350 gallons of fuel.
But none of these are park regens, though. I've never gotten a park regen light.
Okay, so their active regen is telling us that active in their terms means the truck was going down the road, I'm assuming, then, not a parked regen. The weird thing, though, is if we look at the trip report's only on 69,000 miles. The total is on 253. Why is the regen count the same? But the regen time is way different. The regen fuel is almost the same. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Max Force, I have no idea.
Yeah, well, like I say, that's the first one I've ever looked at, but I love looking at stuff like that. That's how we learn.
Okay, well, I'll call you with the oil sample next week. Thanks, Kevin.
All right, sounds great. Let's head off to New Jersey. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call today.
What's on your mind this afternoon?
Well, I have a suggestion for you, and then I have a tire question for you.
Okay, shoot.
My suggestion first is you were saying that you were trying out too many books at one time. Personally, what I like to do is I'll read a book, and I could never 100% absorb a book from A to Z. So if it's a book I really like, I will actually go back over the book, especially if it's a book that I'm trying to learn something from. I'll go back over it, and what I try to do is go back over the book multiple times until either I feel like there's nothing more new for me to learn or I've learned as much as I want to learn from that book.
I absolutely need to do that more. I've known it. It's one of my weaknesses. I love new stuff. I love change. I love new stuff. And I get so into, there's a new book I want to go read. And I've really got to get better at going back to the really, really good books. And I am doing that. Like I say, I'm completely redoing The Seven Habits. I think it's one of the most important books I've ever read. But I've been very, very bad at that over the years. I don't like repetition. I like new stuff. And that's what gets me into this, where I'm reading four books instead of sticking to one. But I am going to do that more. I'm already doing it some, but I am going to do that more. Go back over the really good books. Some books are really garbage, but even right. The worst books, I manage to pull one or two good ideas out of, but they'd never be worth rereading. But some of the good books, like you say, you could probably read some of these books 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 times and still learn something.
I tell you, I'm on number 3 of the third time through for The War of Art, and I can't believe how much I keep learning each time.
Yeah, like I say, I've got to do that more. I think that is a great habit, that when you identify a book that's really good or one that really kind of resonates with you, spend more time in it. Go back.
Okay. Question on tires. Currently, I have Michelin XZA2s on my steers, and I have worn them out, and I'm going to move over to XZA3 pluses, and I'm thinking about going to an H load rated tire versus a G. Is there any real difference in rolling resistance between an H or a G? As far as rolling resistance, I mean, is there any big difference up there at all?
We can only guess. And the reason is that Michelin is, well, now I can't say Michelin is the only tire company doing this. Yokohama's doing it somewhat. There just aren't enough companies testing rolling resistance and publishing numbers. So we just don't know. Mm-hmm. And Michelin, because there's so many tires and new tires coming out all the time, and it's expensive to test, they have decided that they only test one size or load rating of each tire. If you took all the tires out there, then took all the different sizes and all the different load ratings, my God, just start to imagine all of the testing they would have to do. So what they do is they take a tire, like you just mentioned, the XCA 3 Plus. Mm-hmm. Whether it's their tires or somebody else's, they go to the sales data and they find in that particular tire which size and load rating sells the most, which one's the most popular, and that's the one they test. Now, obviously, just understanding physics, any change in that tire, I think, has to change rolling resistance. Certainly size would, the taller the side, the more flex we get. But I would also have to think load rating would. Now, I'm going to try to apply logic to this, and I don't know that logic always works with physics, but it seems to me in order to make a tire handle more weight, you would need a more rigid sidewall, right?
See, this is exactly where I was going with it. And I thought you would think the same thing as me, and you'd probably get better rolling resistance because it's more rigid.
If we make it more rigid, it flexes less, which means it won't get as hot, because that's what causes heat in a tire, all that flexing back and forth. Take a piece of rubber and keep bending it back and forth, it gets hot. In order to hold more weight, we would make it more rigid, less heat, less energy loss. I would think that it would have better rolling resistance. Like I say, we can't always apply logic to physics, but that one sounds like it should work to me. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. So I'm going to continue applying a little more logic. I don't know if it's going to do us any good. The only way we can ever know what the rolling resistance on a tire is to measure it, to put it through the testing and measure it. But I have to believe that the tire design, the tread compound, they're going to be very, very similar. So we should be in the same ballpark. But the other thing that might happen to a tire when we increase the load rating, it's also possible we're making that tire heavier. We should be able to go look at the specs on these tires and figure that out. Maybe I might go do that. And anytime we make the wheel assembly heavier, we increase the unsprung weight, and that does add to the amount of energy it requires to get that assembly moving. You know, none of this is easy. There's always give and take, yin and yang. I'm finding out so much about our health that has so many parallels to the things we talk about in fuel economy and rolling resistance and all these other things. That it's like a lot of things. You know, I've been thinking of analogies and in sports or hobbies. You know, there's the idea of a game or a sport or a hobby that's very, very simple to learn, but extremely difficult, if not impossible, to master. And many sports are like that, really. You think of golf. Golf's a pretty simple sport. You got a club. We could even call it a stick and a ball. And there's a hole out there somewhere. And we have to put the ball in the hole with the least number of hits. I mean, that's as easy as golf is. That's pretty simple to understand. Impossible to master. Fly fishing, I've heard described the same way. And I tried it once and I kind of get it. Within 10 minutes of a couple instructions, I was floating down a river in Montana fly fishing, having a ball. So you can learn it quickly. Probably never, ever master it. So many things are like that. We can get the basics quick and simple. Fuel mileage is not that complicated if we keep it to its basics. And we can make 75% of our improvements in most areas of life just with the basics. It's the last 25% or so that requires the real digging, the detail, the study, the hours and hours of just working on little nuances to master things. The guys who are getting 10 plus miles to the gallon, and we have several of them now, documented real world stuff, pulling real freight, they have come close to mastering fuel economy with everything we know now. But they didn't do that easily. They didn't do it with one thing. They didn't even do it with 10 things or 40 things. If we dig real deep, we probably find out it's 50, 75, maybe even 100 different things, little nuances and tweaks here and there that have gotten them to that point. But I have taken people from 5.5 miles to the gallon to 8 miles to the gallon pretty quickly with mostly just basics. Health and fitness and our life is the same way. We can make huge changes quickly without needing to know a lot of detailed information. After that, we can nuance down to just amazing amounts of detail. People ask me the same thing. Well, Kevin, what did you do to get healthier? You know, I can't tell you that in three sentences. I could give you two or three things that were a big part of it. But so much of it goes so much deeper than that. But the good news is, get the basics down. You can make the biggest part of the improvements in the basics. All right, so my research department sent me some information here. They went and looked it up. The XZA3 Plus H-rated tire weighs 1.4 pounds more than the G in a low profile 22.5. So I was on the right track. In order to make that tire with a higher weight rating, the tire itself got a little heavier, 1.4 pounds. That in my mind, that's fairly significant. Now, how much it affects fuel economy, I don't know. There might be a calculation out there somewhere. But if we also stiffened up the sidewall, did we reduce rolling resistance? This is where we get into those nuances. So let's use this as a parallel or an analogy. If you're running around with a steer tire or any tire that's got a high rolling resistance, you don't need to know any nuance or detail or anything, you know, earth-shattering or specific. All you need to do is lower your rolling resistance and you'll get better fuel economy. How much simpler could that be? The people who have done that and really get into it, And I just think it's part of our human instinct. When we find something we're interested in, we keep digging and learning. And those are the people who want to know information like this. Let's get back to some phone calls. Let's head off to California. George, welcome to the program.
Kevin, good afternoon, morning, whichever it is there. Looking at a sample here, I just want to see if you came to the same conclusion I did about my fuel dilution.
All right.
Small bit of history back there. If you look at sample number 15, we did a six-pack of injectors at that point, at that oil change and sample time.
Okay, before you go on, let me ask why.
Why? Because it was, they can barely get it into the shop to do a B service on it, or an A service. And it was running like crap.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
So it was running.
It was running horribly.
Okay, that makes sense.
At that point in time. And we couldn't get it into Cummins that particular day. I was under a load. We had to get it done. We ordered a six-pack from Cummins, and I stood there, and we did it. I handed them tools, and we knocked it out in one day. So.
Okay. All right. So go on.
So anywho, since that point, I've been kind of eyeballing that fuel dilution has been slowly coming back up. And came back through my records here, and I realized I hadn't even looked at my air filter lately, and I pulled it out and it was quite filthy. So it's being cleaned and re-oiled at this moment in time. Do you think that a severely plugged oil, air filter would be causing that?
Because
everything else seems to be pretty good.
Yeah, it could. And here's how that would happen. You know, we, in order to make a diesel engine run right, we need the correct mixture of fuel and air. If you have too much fuel in the cylinder, or the right amount of fuel in the cylinder, but not enough air to completely combust that fuel, you're going to be left with unburnt fuel in the cylinder. That's what washes down past the rings and causes fuel dilution. So, yeah, it is one of those things that could cause that.
Okay. Well, I didn't know if it was that or if it was just the mileage on this thing. This engine has not been rebuilt yet, and we're at 1,934,000 now.
Wait a minute. You know that for sure? This engine is one?
Yeah, I know that for a fact. I bought this truck with 650 on it. And bought it from I'm the third owner. The first owner was CFI, the second owner was my brother, and now me.
Wow. So, you know, Bruce was telling me about an engine the other day, an N14. Was this possibly the one Bruce Mallinson was talking about?
Probably not.
Okay.
We've talked. It's been into that shop. He never saw it there. But we've talked at various places, you know, like Las Vegas.
It's actually not, because he told me that the one he was talking about was one owner. So he told me he knows of a one owner N14, 1.9 million miles, no in-frame. And I thought, oh, come on, Bruce, are you sure? I mean, I've heard of 1.5 on some Series 60s, but I think that is amazing. A couple cats. But now you're
I talked to a guy here about a year ago who swore up and down he had 3 million on his N14. But I think he was trying to pull my leg a little bit.
But anyway. Wow. Well, two now that we could verify with 1.9. That is amazing. I don't know how.
Yeah.
All these years, I've never known that.
I can make everybody else feel really bad. It still has the original turbo, too.
See, this is what I used to love about Cummins. They used to be such a rock-solid company and such a great engine, and now that ISX, in my opinion, is just a disaster too many times. Hey, great stuff. I think, though, now that you've got the air filter taken care of, let's see what happens to the fuel dilution. But that could very well be what's going on here. The rest of it looks good. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, real quick, just a heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment. At the end, I'll say I'm done. I've got to get out of here. Looks like we've got plenty of calls right now, so let's get back to it. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Tulsa. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, sitting on hold and listening to the other guys, I've got about 1,000 questions, but I'll try and prioritize. I've got an 04 Columbia and the dash, you know, the Columbias are great and everything except the inside, and it's absolutely coming apart. And I've searched, I can't find anything aftermarket. I'm wondering, do I need to go to Freightliner and order a whole new dash and pay whatever the dealer wants me to pay, or is there another option out there?
I couldn't find another option. I did the same thing. And, you know, the Coronado, Columbia, Century, they're all the same dash. I couldn't find, I mean, you can find some aftermarket chrome stuff. And honestly, most of the aftermarket stuff I found was worse than the factory. I bought some aftermarket trim pieces that fit worse than the original factory stuff did. So I was not able to find anything any better. Most of what I found was worse. I did almost an entire interior, from the doors forward. I didn't do anything in a sleeper. This was a day cab, but from the doors forward, and I spent, wow, all together, I spent like over $2,000 in parts, and it took me a good long weekend of doing it all. By the time you get all the switches out and, you know, get all your brake assembly, handbrakes and valves and all that stuff apart and get the whole dash down to the supports, because you have to go all the way back to the supports because it's the supports that break. And then once they break, then the cover pieces start to break because they don't have any support anymore. So it was a job. I mean, it was worth it in my opinion, because now it's back to like new. This is one of the reasons why, you know, when we're looking for older trucks, I wouldn't hesitate to buy one of these, but I look for the Volvos, the PACCARs, and the FLDs first, because their interiors hold up so much better. These three models, Columbia, Century, Coronado, are just known for that horrible dash and interior parts. They just fall apart. So depending on how detailed you want to get from the doors forward, you're going to spend $2,000 to $3,000 in factory parts and a couple of long days.
Well, that's what I was afraid of. The one last one I got, I do mainly oversized flatbed and step deck. Is air tabs and flow below, is that a waste of my time?
Not at all.
I've done.
Okay. Not at all. Here's what we've found over the years. You know, we used to say air tabs are great for pulling a van or a reefer. They fix the air gap problem. And I was off base on that. We were wrong. Forget the trailer for a second. Let's just look at the tractor alone. The tractor alone has some aerodynamic problems. We've got in many cases, and yours is one of them, we've got a very well-designed front end of the vehicle, very aerodynamic. That actually sets up a worse problem, because now we have this really smooth, high-speed air coming but down the sides of the vehicle with very little disturbance, and it catches the back corner, that 90-degree angle, and we create a vacuum right behind the truck. And that vacuum is literally, we know what a vacuum does. It's like somebody standing behind the truck, sucking it the other way, which requires a lot more energy to make it go forward. The next place we have a big aerodynamic problem is around those spinning wheels. We create all kinds of dirty air. Now, no matter what type of trailer we put behind this, we are setting up very dirty air that's going to make our air around the trailer even worse. So we look at aerodynamic problems individually first. Ultimately, what we would love to do is be able to design a whole vehicle that's aerodynamic, but we can't do that, especially with any type of open deck, because it's changing all the time. So all we can do is look at each individual aerodynamic problem and address it with something that makes sense. And the air tabs and the flow below are both inexpensive items that do a terrific job of cleaning up that air, no matter what we're pulling behind us.
Okay. One quick last one. I put the low rolling resistance Michelins all the way around, and I was noticing on the steers, it's probably been 50,000 miles, but they've got a directional arrow on them, and one of them was put on backwards. Once we've already broke in the tread, is it a waste of my time, or should I go ahead and flip one of those tires around because it's mounted backwards?
Yeah, interesting, because that directional arrow really only matters for about the first 30,000 miles anyway. Once you've broken in a tire with it in the right direction, then you can do whatever you want with it. This isn't a huge factor. You know, we're finding that if we have the right tires, and this is a great tire, and we keep the truck aligned and the wheel assemblies balanced, that we are seeing people get 250,000 plus miles out of steer tires now, which is amazing. There's a good chance this tire isn't going to do that. There's a real possibility that at 150 or more, no matter how well you keep everything, you may start to see some river wear on that inside rib. You may see some shoulder coupling. It's hard to say. It's not as important as some people think, but it probably will affect that tire later in life. You know, it couldn't hurt to flip it around now.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Tennessee. Michael, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Kevin, today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I just got a couple of little quick questions. I have a 1998 model Detroit Series 60, and I was wondering, is it really worth my time and money to fix the oil leaks that seem to have developed on this glider kit 1998 model Series 60 that I bought?
My opinion, usually not. And this is a tough one for me because I hate little things like this. They annoy me. You know, I'd like it to be clean.
I'm real anal about my engine being very clean, and it's starting to annoy me that I've fixed about three or four now, and it's only like 2 years old.
Yeah, and this is one of the things we have to deal with when we build these older engines. The problem, you know, we have to look at each individual leak. If we can fix a leak for, say, $400 or $500, you know, 4 or 5 hours labor, I would probably do it. Because I'm like you, it just kind of drives me a little nuts. But if we start looking at 10 or 12 hours of labor to fix a little leak that really isn't even dripping anywhere, it's just kind of making my engine look a little dirty. As crazy as I am about that kind of stuff, I'm just as crazy about my bank account, and that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, if you, in your experience, is a lot of all your Series 60s always dripped oil?
Yeah, it's an engine that develops those little seeps over time, and most of them, in my opinion, are just too expensive to fix. Now, when you're in there doing something else, you know, if we have to replace a clutch and we can get to a rear seal or something, then maybe it's just a couple more hours, then I'll go ahead and do it. If we have to, you know, exhaust manifolds will crack. If we're going to put a new manifold on and we're getting closer to the source of a leak, then I'll go ahead and do it. But normally to tear into an engine to get to one tiny leak, a lot of times just doesn't make sense.
All right. I'm thinking about getting Road King shocks. Is it really worth changing the four on the drives or just the two on the steers?
In my opinion, this is one of those things that it's more of a budget issue than anything else. When if I can afford them all, I will put them all on every single time. The difference. So if we take a vehicle without Road King shocks and we put steer tires on it, we could say you get a 50% improvement in handling. I always say handling, not ride. A lot of people are under the impression that you're going to put these shocks on, you're going to get this dream ride. You really don't. You get a very firm, solid ride. I like it, but some people think they're going to get this truck that floats down the road, which would drive me crazy if it did. So I talk more about handling. The handling of the vehicle improves 50%. But that other 50% will only come from replacing the drive axle shocks. So it really depends. For me, it's worth it. When I have the money, I'll do it every time.
Oh yeah, I just got one. When should I start looking to replace my to Refleet air filters? How long do those stock ones last? I have a 389.
You should be good. You shouldn't have to replace them at all. I mean, you maybe replace the foam wraps, but clean them every 50 to 75,000, and they should last a lifetime. Thanks for joining me. I'm all out of time. I've got to get out of here. I'll see you back here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, here we go. We're going to start on another hour.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show, well, it's all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and we answer your questions about everything trucking. Trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. Hey, I want to remind you, if you filed an extension on your tax return, very common scenario for owner-operators. I know the drill. I've seen it 1,000 times. I've done it myself. You get behind on your paperwork, or you don't have an accounting system, which is very common. So you dread the fact of putting all those papers together and finding all your receipts and adding them all up and getting to the tax preparer. And you have to do all that work most of the time just to get bad news that you have to write a check to the government. Very common for owner operators because we pay all of our own taxes. So you put it off. And you put it off and you procrastinate, and then it comes down to tax time and you file an extension. And then you take a big sigh and you go, oh, okay, good. I've got some time. And then you forget about it and you let it go. Now, there's a couple reasons not to do this. By the time your extension is up, what is it, like October now? I can't even keep it all straight. The year is almost over. And now you're an entire year behind the curve. This is not a good way to run a business. Trust me, I've been there. I've done it. I know that I've done it both ways. I've done it the right way. I've done it the wrong way. I've gone back to doing it the wrong way, gone back to doing it the right way. I know that when you do it the right way, the benefits are immense. You will run a much better business. You will sleep better. You will be more relaxed, and you won't have to constantly think about your tax return out there not done. How much am I going to owe? When am I going to get this done? there's no quick fix to this. You've just got to buckle down and do the hard work. This is one of those areas where I talk about, for many people, myself included, this is part of doing the hard work. And if I could make it easy, then it wouldn't be the hard work anymore. I wish I could, but you've just got to do it. That's the only answer to this. Now, I can make your paperwork easy, somewhat. I can make it simple, but you still got to get through that procrastination and just do it. And there are no real good tricks to that. But if you filed that extension, don't put it off anymore. Don't stop thinking about it. Don't put it out of your mind and feel like you have all this time to get caught up. You don't. You have zero time. You are so far behind the curve. You've got to get on this. Just make a commitment and do it. Get your tax return caught up. And then immediately, right now, you have to do these things at the same time. You have to get your tax return caught up, and you have to get an accounting system in place. Do them both right now. Everything else should be put aside until you get these two things done. If you don't have an accounting system and you filed an extension, get them done. The good news is we can help you with both. We will get you started on your accounting system with one phone call. We'll set it up for you. We'll do the first month for you. We'll get you that momentum going, and then we'll teach you how to do it. We'll be there to answer every question you've got and teach you how to do this and show you how easy it can be. I'm going to give you a phone number in a couple minutes, so grab something to write with. We can also now help you with the tax return. We launched our full service tax this year. We did limit it to a certain number of people. We kept it fairly small this year. We worked out our system, and I am very, very happy with our partner company. And the results on the people we did taxes for have been amazing. The feedback has been outstanding. So we are very pleased with the results. And now we are opening that up to a larger group. So if you filed an extension, one, get your accounting started right now. Get your tax return done right now. We're going to make it really simple. One phone call will take care of both of them for you. Here's the number, 855-800-FUEL, 855-800-3835. Wouldn't it be nice to finally get both of these things taken care of, and then you can relax, sleep better, and run a better business? I guarantee all those things will happen. All you have to do is pick up the phone and make that call. 855-800-FUEL. It'll never be any easier than it will be with that phone number. Let's head off to New York. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Appreciate all your help. I got a question. I run a flatbed. Running from Ohio to Texas weekly. I have 11R 24/5 tall rubber. I was wondering about the option of swapping over to super singles. What would that do to the braking system? Would I have to adjust the camshafts and the chamber rod lengths?
Shouldn't affect your brakes at all. The rims should just bolt right up and you're off and running.
Okay. Now, I set my cruise control at 60, and according to your scan gauge, it's right about 1350 RPM.
Okay.
What I find is if I try to go any slower than 60, I run like across the Western Kentucky Parkway, and I have to shift too often, and I figure that I'm losing my fuel benefits if I'm having to get into the gearbox every time I come to a hill.
What engine and what year?
It's a 98 Freightliner with the 60 series Detroit and a 10 speed overdrive.
Okay. And you are correct that, you know, 1350. Any lower than that with that engine, and you're right, the engine starts to struggle. You will give up fuel economy, and it's annoying. I mean, you're constantly shifting. The good news is, with this tire change, you will probably be able to lower that speed about 3 miles an hour. You should be able to run comfortably through that same area at about 57 instead of 60.
And that's what I was wondering, you know, if I'm able to lower 3 miles per hour and get the fuel pickup for that, it would really help, you know, make the switch profitable.
Oh, no question. Between the lower rolling resistance and the slower speed, this is a hands-down slam dunk half mile per gallon, probably more.
Yeah. Now, I've been running Continentals. I have the latest, the HD, what are the HD3s? They're low rolling resistant.
Okay. Do you? Yeah. I can look up the number real quick. HD3s. Oh, I don't have that. Oh, yeah, I do. The Eco Plus HD3, 106. If you go to the, which wide single are you looking at?
I haven't really started to look. Is Michelin still the best?
Yeah, in my opinion, it is. The X1 line Energy D is 89. So you are lowering your rolling resistance by 17 points. Which means almost 0.2 miles per gallon there. We'll pick up an easy 0.3 with the speed decrease. So, like I said, half mile per gallon, you probably end up saving yourself $4,000 to $5,000 a year. You know, you pay for the tires in less than a year, and everything after that is just money in your pocket.
Okay. I had one other question. I know you always talk about the air taps. Have you ever looked at the Vorblades?
Yeah, I have. I have two basic problems with the Vorblade. One, I don't see any real in-depth testing. It's like many aerodynamic products on the market. They throw a couple random tests from kind of unknown sources out there. They write all the right stuff. It sounds good until you start digging deeper. The air tabs, that design goes back to NASA. I mean, that design is so well researched and documented. That's one big issue. The other one, though, on the Vorblade and some of the other devices, you look at them the first time you go through a set of trees, a couple branches are just going to tear those things all up. That enclosed design, that like shell around it, I don't know that, in fact, that might cause turbulence, honestly. But you stick a branch through that and something's going to break. The air tabs are virtually indestructible. So those are two big reasons why I can't see any reason why I would ever switch from the air tabs on a device like that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Roth. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Hey, you've had a couple minutes to think about the open. If you've got tax and accounting problems, don't put it off. In fact, pull over, find a safe spot to park, take a deep breath, and call us. 855-800-FUEL. I am telling you, it could be one of the single most important things you could do for your business right now. Let's head off to Iowa. Keith, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I want to become an owner operator. I've been driving a truck for about 2 years, back and forth between California and Chicago. I drive for a company. I drive a 2015 Cascadia Evolution, The other day, I asked my employer about an old Peterbilt he had on the lot, and he goes, you want to buy a truck? Why don't you buy the one you're driving? And I've listened to your show for a while now, and it sounded like that's probably not a good idea, but I wanted to call and ask you what your take is on that, and if I did want to buy it, what would be fair price? And I really don't know where to go from there.
What year is the Peterbilt? What year and what model?
You know, I'm sorry, I don't have that information because I just saw it sitting there and I asked him about it and he goes, oh, well, you know, they just kind of put me off on something else. So I don't really know much about it yet.
Okay. So let me just give you a scenario then. Let's say this is actually a pre-emission Peterbilt, because if it's not pre-emission, then I'm not interested at all. I don't care about anything else. If this thing isn't at least an 03 or older, then I'm not interested in either truck. But let's say that it just happens to be an 02. Let's say it's got a pre-emission 6NZ Cat, pretty common combination in a earlier Pete. And let's say we could pick it up for $15,000.
Okay.
$15,000 spent. We know through tons and tons of data and history that we can keep the maintenance cost on that truck under 10 cents a mile, no matter how old it is. We can keep the fuel mileage above 7.5 miles to the gallon consistently. So we honestly, and insurance is going to be extremely cheap because there's not much value to cover, $15,000 or $20,000 worth of value. That's it. So our operating costs are extremely low and predictable, because anything that goes wrong on that truck, we know how to fix it. We've been fixing them for over a decade now. We easily know how to fix anything that goes wrong on that truck. We don't get those stories on these pre-emission trucks of they've replaced 4 turbos, 3 V-pods, 2 EGR valves. It's been in 17 shops and nobody knows what's wrong with it. The DPF, it needs cleaned out every 3 months. That doesn't happen on these old trucks. So the cost is low and predictable. Now, let's talk about this 2015 Cascadia. Is it an Evolution, did you say?
Yes.
$150,000 truck. They may sell it to you for $130,000. Maintenance costs are not low on these trucks. They're 15 to 20 cents a mile, sometimes double the cost of maintaining an old truck. I know that is counterintuitive. People don't believe that, but they only don't believe it because they've never researched the numbers. I've been watching numbers on truck maintenance for 2.5 decades. I have 30,000 owner operators that I can go look at their numbers and document all this stuff, and we have. So the new truck costs more to maintain, not less. Sometimes twice as much. Fuel mileage on that truck could be 9 miles to the gallon. Next month, it could be 5.5, and nobody knows why. Breakdowns, you might end up in 6 or 7 or 8 shops and never figure out what's wrong with it. You might end up with an average of 3 or 4 days of downtime every month while it goes in the shop for this kind of stuff. So now we've got a truck that costs 7 times as much to own, just to purchase it. Plus, you're going to pay a tremendous amount of interest on top of that. You're going to have a huge truck payment to make every single month, whether the truck is running and making any money or not. Maintenance cost, you could end up with a $15,000 or $20,000 bill at some point, and we don't even know why. So I could go buy, in my scenario, I could go buy 7 of those Peterbilts, make. Now, let's talk about this. Whether you buy the 2015 or the 02 in my scenario, do you get paid any differently?
No.
No. So I could go buy 7 of those Peterbilts, make 7 times more revenue than you could with that one 2015, and have lower cost per truck.
Got it.
Doesn't it make so much sense when you look at it that way?
Absolutely does. I have one more question for you then.
Shoot.
I put a big 2,500 watt inverter to run the microwave and my satellite radio and TV and satellite dish. And it works fine when the truck is turned off and the key is off. But if the truck is running thing will go into protection mode and beep, 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 and it'll go off. I have no idea why it gets less voltage when the truck's running than when it's not running. And the inverter is connected directly to the batteries.
Well, electrical can be a little confusing, but the quick answer as to why it gets less voltage is because when you're sitting there and the key is off, the only thing pulling any voltage off the battery is the inverter itself. It has total access to those batteries. The minute we turn the key on, that truck probably has seven different computers on it. So all of those computers start pulling power. There could very well be something electronically wrong with that truck. That's a very common scenario. One of the things we could do is put a multimeter on this truck at certain points in the system, turn the key on and see what the draw is. My guess is something is drawing so much power off those batteries that there's not enough left for the inverter. Could be something. Oh, it could be a thousand things. That's another problem I have with these trucks. They're so electronically complicated. Something as simple as this, our inverter won't work right, can cost thousands of dollars and, you know, tens of hours of troubleshooting.
Right. It could be the 4,000 watt stereo system I have in here also.
Could be, but that really doesn't, well, it does draw quite a bit of power, but again, there's so many things. Forget your stereo system and just look at all the computers, sensors. These trucks are complicated. That's why I don't want to own one yet. Let's head off to Ohio. Roger, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I wanted to, actually speak to you about, you know, health and fitness kind of thing. I had a question for you. I am a company driver, and I really would love to take my bike with me on the road so that when I have my downtime, I can take my bike and go for a ride, get some exercise in. Is there anything okay. that you know of on the market that has like a where I could quickly change it if they saw me or something or my truck breaks down or, you know,
let me think. No, nothing specific. You know, I've looked at a bunch of different carriers and that kind of stuff, and I can't think of anything. Although this isn't really that complicated. I mean, really a couple bungee straps and a cover. I mean, I have a nice bike cover that I got at Camping World that will wrap up two bikes easily, pretty quickly. And a couple bungee straps is all I ever use on any. Well, actually, I don't use bungee straps. I use ratchet straps. And that's all I've ever used to put two bikes up on the back of mine. You know, I can always find something to strap down to. So, you know, I'll throw the cover over them, throw two ratchet straps on it, and 10 minutes at the most, I've got the bike secured down.
Okay. I was thinking that also, but I wasn't sure if there was like a specific mount or something that I could
but they all require some sort of permanent mounting. You know, some of them look real nice, but you're literally going to be screwing into the back of the cab. And I didn't want to mess with any of that. So even though the truck's mine, I still didn't want to mess with any of that stuff. And I found two ratchet straps and a cover works great.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I kind of going along with your health thing that you were talking about earlier. Last year, actually this very day last year, I started a diet and I used to weigh almost 400 pounds and I'm down to 228 right now.
Wow.
Yeah,
that is amazing. You've lost one and a half of me.
I tell you, it's not as hard as everybody thinks. I use an app on my phone. I keep track of what I eat. It's very easy, and it can be done.
You know, I agree with you that, and I'd like to use a different word. It's very simple. I don't think it's easy because people don't change easily. It can be hard work, but I think what you're saying is it's very simple. This isn't rocket science. Like I said earlier, all you need are the basics. You know, if you want to get down to optimal fitness and health, you got to learn a little more and tweak in the nuances. But the biggest gain comes from the simplest, most basic stuff. So congratulations. I mean, that is absolutely life-changing, and you have to feel amazing. I am in awe of people who can do that. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Texas. Lewis, welcome to the program.
Good day there, Kevin.
What's on your mind this afternoon?
Oh, got a couple of things here. You know, at the CMC, you had the, I don't know what you call them there, one-wheeled bicycle?
Unicycles.
Yeah, that's the word. For years and years, I've always kind of been fascinated by those. In fact, went out of my way to look at them at a bicycle store, but just never did buy one because I was always thinking, well, it might be just a, you know, impromptu deal here. And but what do you think about them?
Well, I'll give you my history with them. When my son was about 12 or 13, I think, which means we're probably talking about 12 or 13 years ago. You know, he was like a lot of kids. He was getting way too much into the video games. It was a constant fight to get him outside, and I didn't want to fight with him. So I started thinking of better ways to get him outside and more active. So I started a routine where we got up in the morning and we would go out like 2 hours before he had to be to school, and he could pick anything he wanted to do together with me, and we would do it outside. And so we would keep looking for new things to do. And one year I thought, well, how cool would it be? I'm going to get him a unicycle and I'll just teach him how to ride it. And I didn't get one for myself. I just got him one. So he started goofing around with it. And he got to the point where he could go, 30 or 40 feet. And he started getting a little better at it. And then one day I was just sitting around and I thought, this looks easy. I could do this. And I can get a little, I'm competitive. So when I try something, I am going to figure it out. So I got on this thing and started goofing around with it. And I was able to ride it the first day. Now it was probably about a 6 or 7 hour day. But I had to get started by holding on to something, getting my balance, getting my feet right, pushing off. By the end of the day, I was riding it fairly well. I mean, it was kind of ugly, but I could go down, 100 yards if I wanted to. And then The next thing I wanted to learn was how to just start without holding on to something. That honestly took me almost 3 days of on and off trying. That was harder to learn than it was to learn how to ride it. But I you mentioned it at the CMC, that was 13 years ago or so when I first got one, and I rode it on and off, not a lot, but I rode it on and off for about 4 or 5 years. I would go a couple months without riding, and then I'd grab it and go out and ride again, and you'd get rusty, but I'd pick it up pretty quick. And then I went 8 years without ever riding one, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get back to that. So Lisa bought me a really nice unicycle in company colors for my birthday this year, and took me about 20 minutes of, goofing around. And I can get back on it now, a couple tries, get up and get going. And I could ride, I could ride a mile, if it's nice and level. I'm actually working on some hills now. I think it is an amazing thing to do for a lot of reasons. It requires a lot of really complicated biomechanics thing. And it's interesting that you ask this now, because the book that I'm reading talks a lot about this, about how even people who are working on getting fit many times are spending a lot of time and not getting a lot of benefit. Because you can go to gyms today and see the cardio section is just loaded with people who get on treadmills, stair steppers, bikes. They plug in a set of headphones, they watch, you know, a TV, and they do the same repetitive motion hour after hour after hour. And they don't get a it's better than being sedentary. I don't want to tell anybody you shouldn't do that. But for the amount of time you have to put in and the benefit, we are learning there are much, much better ways. Go out and hike on a trail. Go out and run on a trail. But to go out and do something outside like a unicycle, the benefits are probably 10 to 15 times better than going to a gym and working out. It's the fresh air, the sunshine, the complicated biomechanics of learning how to balance this thing, what it does for your brain and your body. So, yeah, if you even have a little bit of interest in it, I would highly recommend you get one.
Okay, great, great. Hey, I was really impressed the other day. Well, I was impressed at the show there in the parking lot with, I believe his name is Eldon.
Yes.
And I'm going to be looking forward to going by and visiting his shop. But the other day he called, last weekend, and he was talking about brakes, et cetera, with you.
Right. Yep.
And I noticed how he mentioned, he mentioned us, and you mentioned we. And you were talking, y'all were talking about the percentage of out of service brakes. And I know you're a previous driver, so I can see more of that for sure. But Eldon, as a mechanic, was included himself with us drivers. And I've been, you know, trucking since 06, which isn't a long time. But I just thought that was fantastic. And I can't wait to get up there and let him do some work on my truck.
Well, you know, Eldon has such a great background in history and trucking. Eldon has driven a lot of miles, owned a lot of
trucks. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, that's it. All right. I got
just a absolute top-notch mechanic. And the other thing I love about Eldon, here's something else. And I don't know that Eldon even knows this. When I first started the radio show back in 07, so we're over 8 years now on the air, Eldon was the first listener that ever sent me an email. And I still remember the email to this day. I was living in Florida at the time when I started the radio show, and Eldon sent me an email inviting me to an event, and I think it had something to do with horses, in Colorado. And I thought, wow, that is such a cool thing, you know, that, you know, he reached out to me, sent me this email. So I've never forgotten that. So Eldon's been, you know, part of our tribe here for a very, very long time. But the other thing I love about Eldon is that he is the most patient teacher I've ever seen. So when you go into a shop, the one thing I tell people is don't go in there when you're in a hurry, because that's not how Eldon works. Eldon is very, very detailed. He gets it right, but he takes his time, and he loves to have the people like right there with him, so you learn things as he's working on your truck. There's really no other shop like it. It's more of an experience, a learning experience than anything else. And you're going to get great work done on your truck. Just don't be in a hurry.
Yeah, right. Very good. Thank you.
You are welcome. Thanks for the call. All right. So, yeah, Eldon is one of those guys that is just absolutely amazing when it comes to teaching. He gives a lot back to this industry. So if you're ever through Lincoln, Nebraska, check him out. Again, don't go in when you're in a hurry. But if you want to go in and you want to take some time and get some work done right and learn something, I can't think of anybody better. Let's go to California. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Hey, I need to replace my wide singles. I have the X1 XD8 Energy, which I think now, didn't they replace that with the X1 Line Energy D?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. So what's the difference between that one and the XDN2s? Do you recommend the XDN2s?
I don't. And, you know, I think people that listen to this show know the first thing I look for in tires is always rolling resistance first. And the, I got to go back and find it because I don't pay attention. The X1 XDN2 has a rolling resistance of 119. The Energy D is 89. So you're looking at 30 point difference, and that equates to 0.3 mph. That's just way too big for me to give up.
Oh yeah. Okay. Definitely. Okay. All right. Well, that's all I needed to know.
All right. Thanks for the call. I'm going to take us into a break. When we come back, we'll see how many calls we can get to, but there's the music. So I'll take us into the break. When we get back, we'll get right back to the phone calls and we'll knock out as many as we can before I've got to get out of here for the night. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. If you need any help from us, whether it's tax, accounting, fuel mileage, you name it, we're here. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to that dreaded final segment. I always hate this part of the show because I know it's about to end, but let's get to as many calls as we can. Let's head off to South Carolina. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hello, Mr. Rutherford. I'll get right down to it. Got a tip there for people who need newer trucks, but and I know Schneider has used gliders that they're selling. I occasionally get an email from them and stuff like that, and they got 12.7 Detroits, 10 speeds, and 264 gears. So, I mean, it's a pretty efficient setup.
I've been wondering when this was going to happen because if I remember right, aren't most of these gliders like 2012, 2011, 2012 models?
Somewhere in there, yeah.
I remember when I was seeing hundreds and hundreds of gliders being delivered to Schneider, and they built a bunch of these back then. And I thought, you know, most fleets only keep trucks for 3 or 4 year cycles, so we should start seeing those Schneider gliders coming up for sale. And it sounds like they are now. That is a great option for people who are looking for trucks.
Typically, they're actually all the ones that they had that I saw there were all Columbias, which personally I think is a better looking truck than the Sentry. And from what I could see in the email, they were like 60, 70, somewhere in there.
Would it be possible for you to forward one of those emails to me?
Yeah, I'll talk to Lisa once I'm done with it.
Yeah, I'd love to see the details on those because I think that is a fantastic option for a lot of people. I really appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Not a problem. Remember over the weekend, you shared a story about a GMC Astra that it was so bad you never even put the door panel back on. And I was wondering, were the old Ford, like the Aerostar, not the Aerostar, the Aeromaxes, were they that bad in quality too, or were they a little bit better?
You hit it on the head. They were a little bit better. Now, I had an 84 Astro, which was absolute junk. I got to say, I made a bunch of money with the truck. I remember it fondly, but it was really junk. And I had a 95 Aeromax. Now, that 95 made me a tremendous amount of money. I bought it new. Brand new, spec'd it all out. It was a single axle sleeper. I put a team on it. Originally, that team ran Orlando to LA and back every week. And then over the years, I had different team runs. And I put 1.3 million miles on that truck. It had a Series 60 in it.
Dang.
I only changed the oil four times in 1.3 million miles. That was my first truck ever with a bypass oil filter. I thought that was amazing. I never touched a single part on that engine. No turbos, no injectors, no in-frame, no nothing. Other than when the very first year I had it, both the air conditioner and the alternator kept throwing belts and the brackets would break. And I ultimately had somebody fabricate new brackets for me because they were junk. But internally, that engine was top-notch. The truck itself, it was noisy. The doors sounded like tin cans when you closed them. I put a couple of really nice seats in it, so at least seats were comfortable. But, you know, and the dash held up really well because it was all pretty solid metal. It just wasn't luxurious. The fit and finish wasn't good, those kind of things. But, boy, did I make a ton of money with that truck.
And one quick two questions about tires. One, you're great about the wide base singles, but how much of a rolling resistance hit do you take if you go with the 455 version as opposed to the 445 series?
Yeah, the problem there is we have to guess. We don't know because they don't test different size of a tire, but we do know when you make the sidewall taller, you increase rolling resistance. It's impossible not to because the sidewall is going to flex more. We end up with more unsprung weight, but we can only guess at the numbers. Is there a reason you need the taller tire?
I'm still trying to spec everything out. It's got 20 low pro 24 fives on it now. And I was going to try and switch to the 22.5, but I was trying to play with numbers. Maybe I could keep low pro 24.5. It's mainly an RPM versus speed kind of thing. It's more of a math game in my head at the moment than anything else. And I'm just numbers.
Let me ease your mind. The rolling resistance is far more important than the RPM. By going to the smaller tire size, you're going to increase RPM slightly. That will have almost and possibly zero effect on fuel economy. It may even have a positive effect on fuel economy. And the rolling resistance by going to the smaller tire will always be positive. So don't rack your brains too much on the math. Go with the smaller tire.
All righty. Well, you have yourself a great night, and I'm gone. Actually, let me go back to Lisa so I can give her the email.
Will do. I'll send you back there. Lisa will pick you up. And if you could forward that email to me so we can get that information out for people, I would appreciate it. Let's head off to Virginia. Adrian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I got a 07 Peterbilt 387 with a 06 Acer in it. And I'm going to be needing to get it rebuilt here pretty soon. And I'm just deciding whether or not I should drop off all the Acer stuff or not, just seeing whether that's going to be cost effective. And one of the things that I'm considering is if I do need a repair, where would I be able to take my truck after I did those modifications?
Yeah, you bring up all kinds of issues here, so let's dive right in. I can absolutely tell you that when you are doing an in-frame or an out-of-frame on an ACERT, it is worth every penny to de-ACERT that engine. The results are amazing. We have seen engines pick up a full mile per gallon, better throttle response. That is an amazing engine underneath all that junk. And when you get it all off there, the results are incredible. So there, hands down, it is worth doing from a fuel mileage, performance, and maintenance standpoint. But we have to move on to the legal issues, the compliance issues. Technically, it's illegal. We're not allowed to modify the emissions on any engine. And we have heard some stories of trucks going into bigger shops, bigger dealership type shops, certified CAT owned shops, things like that. And I have a handful of these stories where people claim, and I've done some follow up on this. I think that some of it is verifiable, that there have been stories of shops saying emissions are modified. We are not allowed to let this engine back out of the shop until they're corrected. That doesn't surprise me. That would be the way the EPA would enforce this kind of stuff, by going through the big shops. If it were happening a lot, I would think I would be hearing of it more. And I've heard a couple stories, but that is such a huge risk that you have to consider it. I mean, if you are going to modify a truck like this, you've got to be very, very careful who you let work on it, because you don't want to be that one story where you've got this truck that you spent another, on top of your in-frame, you're probably going to spend another $3,000 or $4,000 in additional parts to make it right. And you don't want to be that one truck that ends up in a shop and they won't release it until you spend $12,000 to make it the way it used to be. I mean, that would be a horrible position to be in. So as much as I'd love the results, you've got to think long and hard about whether or not this is worth it. For me, I would say it wouldn't be worth it for me. The risk would be too great. You know, you get stuck at, now, if you are going to do it, you need to work very hard at finding independent shops around the country that you could go to that aren't held to those same EPA standards. And, you know, they're not under that kind of scrutiny that you could build a relationship with. You could get your truck fixed when you need it fixed, because I think the risk of taking a modified truck into any of the factory shops or dealerships is just too big.
Now, would that happen even if, like, I had them working on the, you know, just the cab? I mean, I haven't had any problems with the engine, really. You know what I mean?
If I took all the problems I have had, have been
ACERT related. You know?
Yeah, no, I get it. The problem is I don't know the answer. It could be that the EPA will crack down and say every truck that rolls through the door, you have to check emissions. I don't know. That risk seems too much to me, though. I'm all out of time. We'll have to talk about that again next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.